Call the next case.
Call the next Commonwealth, Kevin C. Gaynor, Appellant Counsel, Christopher P. Candela, Appellant Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kevin Gaynor. I represent the appellant in this case, Abdul Cole. At this time, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Cole is appealing the Court of Appeals' decision to reverse the trial court's granting of appellant's motion to suppress, and the Court of Appeals' decision upholding Mr. Cole's conviction for possession with intent to distribute cocaine second offense. This court awarded an appeal on these issues on February 22, 2017. There are three issues on appeal. The first issue effectively is, I think, moot. I'm going to address the second two issues, but I'm going to use most of my time on the second issue, which is the motion to suppress issue. In this instance, and thereafter, I'll address the possession with intent to distribute issue as time permits. I will rely on my brief for any issues that I'm unable to address due to time constraints. Procedurally, very briefly, an interlocutory appeal was filed by the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office after a motion to suppress was granted in the trial court. The Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's ruling granting the motion to suppress, remanded the case back to the trial court for trial. At trial, Mr. Cole was found guilty of possession with intent to distribute cocaine second offense, and this appeal followed. The second issue in this case, the issue I would like to predominantly address, is whether the Court of Appeals correctly applied Florence to Mr. Cole's case. Specifically, what we're talking about here is the decision to be made, I think, is whether Florence applies to Mr. Cole's case. If it doesn't, whether Mr. Cole's case falls into the exception alluded to by Justice Alito in his concurring opinion in the Florence case. And thirdly, whether this court should adopt that exception, as other jurisdictions have done, as an exception to the Florence ruling. The Court of Appeals, in its unpublished opinion in this matter that was dated February 13, 2015, construed Florence as setting forth a general rule that detainees being admitted to the general population of a jail facility could be strip searched without individualized reasonable suspicion, regardless of the severity of the charges they faced. The Court of Appeals conceded in its decision that while Mr. Cole's custody status had not been determined at the time of the strip search, specifically he had not gone before a magistrate and it was unclear whether or not he would enter a general population, he was going to be kept at least briefly in an area in booking where the court felt he would commingle with other detainees in various stages of the commitment process, giving him ample opportunity or others ample opportunity to pass off or hand off contraband hidden on their person.
So while he wasn't post-magistrate assigned to general population of a jail, he was having substantial contact in the pre-magistrate context with other detainees.
I believe that finding was erroneous, Your Honor. Deputy Pankey, during the second day of the motion to suppress hearing, testified at length about the makeup of booking and its design.
I will accept entirely, of course, your argument that it's wrong factually, but hypothetically, assume it's true. That is Section 4 of Florence, which is the court saying, look, we're saying you can do this, but we're not addressing situations where the person's not actually assigned to general population in the jail, and, underscore and, situations where he may not be assigned to general population, but he nonetheless has substantial contact with detainees. And Alito picks up on exactly that point when he says, and who could be held in available facilities apart from the general population. So you see where this is heading, right? So the logic of both Alito and Roberts in concurrence with Kennedy's plurality on this point is if you have substantial contact with the detainees, it doesn't really matter whether it's pre- or post-magistrate, because the theory is still the same.
I understand the court's question, and I think the answer is back to where I had started, which was the evidence didn't establish that he had substantial contact with inmates whether they were general population inmates or other inmates whose commitment status had not been.
I got that. So I'm not asking you to concede anything. I just want to make sure I'm understanding you. Are you really arguing that even if he did have substantial contact with these detainees in this area, that would be a violation of Fourth Amendment?
Depending upon the nature of those detainees, if we're talking about substantial contact with general population detainees, then I think that falls within Florence.
Okay. Well, there's common ground then.
But in this instance, Your Honor, I believe Deputy Pankey's testimony established the fact that Mr. Cole did not have substantial contact and, in fact, maybe had no contact with other inmates, whether they be general population inmates or not, during his stay in the jail prior to the strip search and visual body cavity search. The evidence was that he was brought into the jail by Officer Moore and almost immediately, was immediately taken to Deputy Rowland, who made a very quick determination that he was going to be strip searched, and then he was moved for the strip search. There's no indication that he had contact with anyone during that period of time prior to the strip search or visual body cavity search.
Well, it's not actual contact, it's the availability of contact. You don't have to wait for the detainee to start whispering to the guy next to him.
Well, then I think we have to go back to exactly what type of contact he could have to general population inmates while he's in booking. And I think looking at Deputy Pankey's testimony in this particular case, the answer to that is slim to none. I would concede that general populations on occasion are in the booking area. But the booking area generally does not house general population inmates. There are general population inmate housing units on the first floor, but they're in a different part of the facility behind locked doors.
But
and you would have to go down hallways or leave the booking area and the observation of the deputies in order to get to those units.
Isn't the point, though, is contact with other people and law enforcement officers such that you could spread contraband, you could use a weapon. But I thought the evidence was clear that there was this potential for contact with other people and law enforcement.
I don't think it's just other people. I think it's other people who are general population.
What is the significance of general population? I mean, the point is, all right, you're in this holding area. There's other people around you. You get in an argument, pull out a weapon, or you spread your contraband, and that's destructive to what the jail is trying to accomplish. Why does it matter if we call it general population or anything else?
Well, first and foremost, Your Honor, the language in Florence talks about the difference between general population inmates and non-general population inmates. What they're trying to prevent largely is contraband going into the general population of the jail, not the holding cells. They want it to be prevented anywhere, obviously, but the predominant interest is preventing weapons, contraband, drugs from going into the general population areas of the jail, which in Alexandria are typically the upper floors of the jail.
But there are cells in the booking area.
There are cells
and
in the booking area.
People are held there sometimes for a couple of days. There's no legitimate penological interest in stopping drugs and guns and knives and et cetera from going into those cells. There's 25 guys there in that area, and there's four deputies.
Well, Your Honor, again, number one, the individuals who will be in those cells, and I understand that you don't necessarily agree with the distinction between general population inmates and non-general population inmates, but we do know that someone in Mr. Cole's position is not going to have contact in those cells with general population inmates because they're not housed together and they're easily distinguishable because general population inmates wear jail uniforms. Non-general population inmates are those that have not been determined to be moving into the general population are typically in their street clothes. So it's easy to tell them apart. They're kept directly in front of four deputies in the booking department, unless they're in one of these cells, and they're only in those cells either alone or with individuals whose commitment status also hasn't been determined.
So one of those 25 guys couldn't go up to the bars of that cell and slip them through the bars to get into the general population?
Well, Your Honor, again, that would require contact with the general population inmate, and I believe the evidence was pretty clear that the likelihood of contact in any meaningful way or substantial contact, as Justice Kennedy talks about in his plurality opinion, simply isn't present in the Alexandria Adult Detention Center. It's designed to prevent that type of contact. And, in fact, in this particular case, there's no indication that any such contact occurred. And, in fact, no indication that there was any contact with any detainee, whether he be general population or not. I think it's important to look at what we know, what is undisputed factually in this case regarding determining whether Florence applies or the exception, I would call the exception to Florence as set forth by Justice Alito should apply here instead. We know that Mr. Cole was arrested for possession of marijuana and open container. We also know that he was arrested for a failure to appear from another jurisdiction, but Deputy Rowland, who made the, well, through his supervisor, made the decision to do the strip search, had no recollection of the warrant from another jurisdiction. All he remembered was it was possession of marijuana and an open container, one of which was non-jailable, one of which had a maximum penalty of 30 days in jail. Officer Rowland conceded that he got permission for the strip search based solely upon the nature of the charge, possession of marijuana. He gave no other information to the supervisor. The supervisor didn't ask for any other information. That prompted permission for the strip search. At the time of the strip search or the visual body cavity search, and I would suggest that it was actually a visual body cavity search because as described in Virginia, a visual body cavity search includes where you manipulate or look at the genitals and buttocks area and potentially even inside the person's mouth. All of those things happen in this particular case. So prior to this visual body cavity search, the other fact that is not in dispute is that Mr. Cole had not been taken before a magistrate. His custody status had not been determined. And I would argue again that there were ample opportunities to keep him separate and apart to the extent necessary from certainly general population inmates and specifically any inmates.
But there are people, as I understood the record, in the assessment process awaiting admission to general population. There were detainees awaiting to go into court. There were people waiting for a bond who are in custody. It's 25, roughly, people milling around under the supervision of four deputies, some of which were behind bars, some of which are not. How is that not the proper context for there to be an interest in excluding contraband and weapons?
There is an interest in excluding contraband from going into the facility. And
what about into the courtroom? What about into the magistrate's office?
Well, Your Honor, I understand what the court's saying. And if somebody is being brought to the courtroom, well, let me take a step back. If somebody is handing off contraband to an individual in one of those holding cells who later then is committed to general population, that person is going to be strip searched under Florence because he's being placed in general population.
Well, can I interrupt you right there? It seems like that's quite a concession, because if that scenario would occur, that's the very reason why Florence in Section 4 and Alito and Roberts in their concurrences made a point of saying, look, even if you're not in that context, if you are substantially in the same presence, that the possibility could exist to bring that contraband into the hands of a detainee before he goes back into general population, then there should be this rule.
Well, Your Honor, I think the reason that Justice Alito suggested the exception that he did in Florence is because of the very nature of strip searches and visual body cavity searches. They're humiliating, they're offensive, and absent justification for it, and that justification being reasonable to achieve a penological interest, you shouldn't. Florence and Justice Alito and even Justice Kennedy recognize that there may be exceptions, and Justice Alito specifically stated what that at least one exception should be, which most or the majority of jurisdictions that have considered this have adopted. But
also, doesn't Florence say that you have to defer to the judgment of correctional officials unless the record contains substantial evidence showing their policies are an unnecessary or unjustified response to problems of jail security?
Yes,
how do you think that impacts the burden of proof here?
Your Honor, I think Justice Breyer very persuasively in his dissent in Florence talked about whether this was a reasonable response to this penological interest in this case. In fact, he went through multiple studies and surveys that the court apparently had adopted as helpful and accurate that dealt with tens of thousands of detainees. And he pointed out that it appeared that a matter of a handful or less would have been able to, and I think it was basically significantly less than 1%, would have been able to secret contraband into the jail that wouldn't have otherwise been found through a reasonable basis test that was already in place. So in other words, Justice Breyer said the justification for this seems to not exist. That in fact, this doesn't happen with any specific regularity.
Right, but the majority rejected that reasoning. I mean, I think if we were on a blank slate, I would say, oh, well, that's an interesting argument. Let's figure it out. But now we're bound by what the majority said, which is the standard of deference. Are we not?
I understand that, Your Honor. And could you state the question again? I'm sorry.
No.
I'm the question.
Right.
Very well, Your Honor. As I'm running out of time, we know that Mr. Cole was not taken before a magistrate. I would argue that the evidence established that he could be kept in the booking area without substantial contact, certainly with general population inmates, or substantial contact with any inmates, given the makeup and the description of booking that we had in this particular case. If Florence doesn't apply, and this falls, it appears, within the exception to Florence that Justice Alito suggested and that other courts have adopted, then this is controlled by the Bell versus Wolfish standard of reasonable basis. And when you look at the four factors under Bell versus Wolfish, as were examined by the trial court in this particular case too, you find that there is simply no reasonable basis for this search. They knew nothing about Mr. Cole at the time of this search. Mr. Cole had no history with the arresting officer, with any of the deputies. They knew nothing about his history. They had no information, as in Craddock, for instance, that this person had secreted drugs on his person before. They had no idea even where the drugs were found, the fact that it was residue, the fact that it was in a bag of trash.
Your time has expired, and you're into new material, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would ask that I reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. Chris Chanaville on behalf of Commonwealth in this appeal. In the second assignment of error, Mr. Cole argues that the trial court correctly refused to apply the standards and principles enunciated by the Supreme Court of the United States in Florence versus Board of Chosen Freeholders, despite the fact that the context of that case and the principles of the court enunciated in that case were principles that the court had repeatedly applied in the specific context of policies and procedures devised by institutional officials to deter and prevent the possession of contraband in their facilities. Those principles date all the way back to a 1974 case by the United States Supreme Court called Pell versus Procurier, and that case, that principle was reaffirmed just a few years later in the Bell versus Wolfish case. And in both of those cases, what the U.S. Supreme Court said was, and it's the standard that was Justice McClanahan mentioned just a few moments ago, that as long as the policy that is devised by the correctional official is designed to preserve internal order, to encourage good discipline, and to maintain institutional security, that those considerations are uniquely within the province of those security officials. And so as long as there's not substantial evidence in the record that those policies are an exaggerated response to institutional concerns of security, trial courts must defer to those security officials' judgment. The Procurier decision dealt with First Amendment challenges of the detainees' ability to have interviews with members of the press, and the court in that case applied this standard and said there must be substantial evidence in the record that policy is an exaggerated response to institutional concerns. Similarly, in Bell versus Wolfish, the court applied that standard. That case dealt with visual body cavity searches after contact visits. And in that case, the Supreme Court of the United States said that policy is designed to prevent contraband in this facility, and thus we're going to apply that deferential standard that requires substantial evidence in the record for the detainee to show there's substantial evidence in the record. That is an exaggerated response to security concerns. So in Florence, the United States Supreme Court was not inventing a new standard out of whole cloth that applies specifically to general population individuals. It was applying a well-established principle for determining when an institutional facility devises a policy designed to keep out contraband. This is the standard that the trial court must consider and that the detainee must prove before that judgment is going to be questioned by courts or by detainees and litigants, as is being done here. So for that reason, this principle applies equally well, not just to general population inmates, but also to pretrial detainees. And I think a great place to go for this court to determine how do we do this analysis as to whether or not the principle applies to pretrial detainees who are not in the general population, as it does to general population pretrial detainees. In Bell versus Wolfish, in footnote 29, There is a dispute in that case about whether or not these principles should apply not only to convicted inmates, but should also apply to pretrial detainees. Now, in Bell, the issue was pretrial detainees who were going to the general population. But to that point, the United States Supreme Court had not yet determined whether or not pretrial detainees should be treated in the same way that convicted inmates are treated for purposes of these constitutional tests. And what the United States Supreme Court said in footnote 29 in Bell was that the same security concerns underlying the policy of strip searching these convicted inmates also apply with pretrial detainees.
That's interesting because the second paragraph of Florence says that Bell, quote, is the starting point, end quote, for the analysis.
Correct, Your Honor. And Bell was applying that standard, which actually came out of the Procureur case. But Procureur dealt with First Amendment challenges. Bell dealt with Fourth Amendment challenges. So I think the court in Florence was correct that Bell versus Wolfish is the starting point for determining what analysis should a reviewing court do in the context of a Fourth Amendment challenge to a policy that's specifically designed to prevent the possession and introduction of contraband into a facility. So in footnote 29 of Bell, what the court holds is that there are two reasons why we defer to corrections officials in this particular context. The first reason is that corrections officials are the experts. Litigants are not the experts. Courts are not the experts in terms of the best way to secure a facility for purposes of keeping not only the detainees and the inmates safe, but also keeping the employees of that facility safe, and keeping the individual detainees who might be smuggling in contraband themselves, keeping them safe. And that those security officials are the experts and courts are not the experts. So absent some substantial evidence that they've exaggerated their response, courts should defer to those experts. And that applies equally to convicted inmates and equally to general population inmates. And Commonwealth would submit that it applies equally to pretrial detainees who are not yet moved into the general population, whereas here the record demonstrates that those pretrial detainees are having substantial contacts with other pretrial detainees. And I'll just mention briefly, the second reason is because there's a separation of powers principle that underlies this entire discussion, which is that the control and the operation of corrections facilities are primarily within the executive and legislative branch. And that's what the United States Supreme Court said in Bell versus Wolfish. And they're not primarily the prerogative of the judicial branch. And that principle applies equally true for convicted inmates as it applies to pretrial detainees, is what the court said in Wolfish. And I would submit that it applies equally here to pretrial detainees who have not yet been moved into the general population of the facility.
Tempers can flare as these folks are sitting around amidst each other. People can overdose in the pretrial or in the general population, pretrial, et cetera. I mean, it doesn't matter. You're in contact with other people in a way that the deputies can't necessarily quickly stop.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And those health and safety concerns apply equally when there's substantial contact between pretrial detainees in the booking area, as there was here, as they apply in the general population. What my opposing counsel has submitted to the court is that in Florence, the United States Supreme Court was saying, we're concerned about the health and safety of general population inmates, but somehow we're less concerned or we're not concerned about the health and safety of pretrial detainees who are not yet in the general population. And that proposition cannot be correct. Of course, corrections officials should be concerned about the health and safety of not only their general population inmates, but also their pretrial detainee inmates. So in circumstances as here, where there are those substantial contacts amongst pretrial detainees who are not yet in the general population, reviewing courts must defer to security measures taken and designed by corrections officials to keep out contraband, not only from moving into the general population, but also from being spread around various pretrial detainees within that booking area.
And help me out with the record here. This gentleman was arrested on a routine traffic stop.
Yes, sir.
And the officer determined through checking that there was an outstanding warrant for failure to appear in a neighboring jurisdiction. Is there significance to that in this case as far as the Commonwealth is concerned? And the only reason why I ask is it seems inevitable that he is going into general population because he's going to be eventually, pursuant to the capias, delivered to the other jurisdiction. Is that anything of importance to the Commonwealth?
I think there absolutely could have been significance to that fact had the record played out somewhat differently. If I remember correctly, the testimony was that while there was this outstanding warrant, there was a concession by either one of the Commonwealth's witnesses or the Commonwealth itself that he still may have been granted bond and therefore would have been allowed to be released before being transferred over to Arlington.
But he may have. I mean, the point that's being made is that he may not have.
Yes, Your Honor.
He's got a failure to appear. A lot of judges would say, no, he had his chance. He's not getting any more bond now. Why would you grant someone with a failure to appear a bond when there's a capias pending?
I think that's absolutely correct. So it's most likely that he's not going to be released and that he would ultimately end up in the general population.
Particularly on a failure to appear.
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, a capias issued on a failure to appear, generally speaking, and there's exceptions, you're being held until we secure your appearance.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that point gets back to a fundamental difference that I have with the case that was presented my opposing counsel, is that the question is not looking after the fact, how long was this individual within this pretrial booking area and how many contacts did he have or did he not have during the time that he was there. The question has to be, at the time of the search, what is the potential for contacts with other detainees in that area, and what is the potential that he's eventually going to be transferred and going to a general population somewhere? But more importantly, what contacts is he going to have with other pretrial detainees that would lead to possible violent confrontations, would lead to the possibility he's going to ingest these drugs and put his own health at risk? What are the considerations at issue at the time the search is conducted? And I know my opposing counsel has submitted here this afternoon that the factual finding by the trial court that there were going to be substantial contacts was an erroneous finding. However, I would point the court to pages 203 through 202 through 203 of the appendix. And at that part of the appendix, there's a discussion between defense counsel and the trial court about whether or not these drugs could be admissible subject to this inevitable discovery doctrine. Well, eventually, perhaps, the search would be conducted and they would be found. And in rebuttal to that argument, my opposing counsel argued to the trial court that it was not at all clear whether he was going in the jail population. And number two, this is at page 203, there was a break between him coming into booking and him going into the jail population of two or three or however many days where he is interacting with other individuals or at least is mixed in with other individuals in the booking area. So there's no indication that even if he had gone in the jail population two or three days later that this item would have been found or still have been on his person. So what he's conceding is that there were substantial contacts. There were going to be contacts between himself and other pretrial detainees. And not only that, he's implicitly arguing that because he would have had opportunities to pass off the drugs to other pretrial detainees, that the inevitable discovery argument doesn't work. Those are factual concessions that are binding on him in this appeal. So he's conceded that the trial court was correct that there were opportunities to pass off these drugs to other pretrial detainees, to be in contact with other pretrial detainees. And for that reason, the reasoning that the court applied in Florence, which is the same reasoning it had applied all the way back to Bell versus Wolfish and Procurator before it, certainly applies in this context where there are those sort of contacts between various people within the facility, and the health and safety concerns are certainly just as large and significant concerns within this context as they would be within general population. What Mr. Cole is asking this court to do is to play expert and to tell the detention facility, this is how you can best serve the needs of your inmates and keep your people safe and keep the inmates safe. What the Supreme Court of the United States has repeatedly held is that is not the role of the courts, and that is not the role of litigants. That's primarily the role of these institutional officers who have as their primary responsibility the health and safety of their detainees and their employees. There was not substantial evidence in the record in this case that those policies were an exaggerated response to security concerns. That was the defendant's burden, and there was no evidence put forth to support that finding. For these reasons, his second assignment of error must fail. For the reasons stated on brief, his third assignment of error as to the sufficiency of the evidence also must fail. An expert testified that all the evidence in the record was inconsistent with the conclusion that he had these 5 to 10 grams of cocaine on this person for personal use.
Before you leave, I take it you agree that the law of the case issue is a moot issue. We didn't need to.
Yes, Your Honor. We do agree that the Court of Appeals at least erred in that particular conclusion.
But it's moot for purposes of our analysis because we're reviewing it de novo anyway.
Correct, Your Honor. The underlying ruling by the Court of Appeals when the first case first came up on the Commonwealth's appeal that Florence does apply and that this search was permissible is correct. We would ask the Court to affirm that and to affirm Mr. Cole's convictions. Unless there are any additional questions, I will rest on my brief.
All right.
Thank you,
Mr. Mayor, your time has expired, and so you have no rebuttal. Call the next case.